Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, episode number 118. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about some cutting-edge intel coming out of the Lima Charlie community Slack channel. It's another week, another set of bad actors, malicious files, and compromised systems. On today's show, we're going to be talking about some of the cutting-edge intel being shared by our awesome community in the Lima Charlie Slack channel. And a huge thank you to all those folks that take the time to share their knowledge with the rest of us. If you enjoy listening in on these Intel chats and aren't in our community Slack channel yet, then you should join the conversation. Much more information than we can get through on the show is being shared there, and you will get it in real time. You can join the Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. And as always, for these chats, I'm joined by the one and only Matt Bromley. How are you doing today, Matt?
Hey, Chris. It's great to see you. And as always, I am doing very well. Absolutely loving it. I just got a chance to spend some time at Google Next last week. We also had a very, very busy week on our Lima Charlie front last week. So it's great to be back here with you, but lots of cool stuff going on as well.
Yeah, that I saw some videos from the event. It definitely looked like an interesting venue.
It was my first time there, actually. I'd never been to Next before. I've been to Vegas and conferences in Vegas many, many times. But this one was actually really cool. Hats off to the team at Google Event Planning or whoever they are. They put on one heck of an event. Very, very nice aesthetics. Very, really cool place to be. I know that sounds like a weird conference takeaway, but sometimes you go into a room and there's thousands of people and you feel like there's 20 times that. This one actually felt really like kind of warm and welcoming. And it was pretty neat to be in there. Lots of great presentations, really good talks, lots of good research. I enjoyed it. Not necessarily a lot of, you know, cyber threat intel and stuff like that, but for anyone who's curious, kind of on that maybe builder entrepreneurial side, especially in the space of cybersecurity building, definitely go check out some of the talks from this year. There was a lot of good content.
Yeah, it's really a developer-focused event, right?
Yeah, yeah, very developer-focused. A lot of AI. A lot of AI. You can imagine it's AI everything these days, but yeah. Still, it was a good event. Had a lot of really, really good time with it.
Awesome. Okay. Well, lots of stuff to catch up on. We missed last week, so let's get to it. The first one I have was pulled from Twitter and sent me down a bit of a rabbit hole. The tweet reads, eCentire's threat response unit has observed fake bat loader being distributed via fake updates, ultimately leading to a Luma C2 infection via a custom-written pkrun PE provided by the fake bat threat actors. Pkrun PE is using a naming convention or at least an acronym that I'm not sure that everybody will know. Can you help our listeners out on that one, Matt?
Yeah, this one is a really interesting term in this case. The way that I viewed this one, first off, the run PE part for anyone there, the run PE portable executable is typically referring to a binary of some sort that can get kind of passed around or shared. An exe in the Windows world, portable executable is often going to be, I should say PE is typically used to describe Windows executables, but it can really be any executable in that sense, also commonly referred to as a binary. In this case, it just depends on kind of the approach, you know, that you want to take. The headers in them are a little bit different. I won't go down the whole hex rabbit hole necessarily, but we will go down that kind of road and just say that PE often refers to, again, a portable executable side of things for anyone who's reading this and is like, where did they get all these different names from? And then, of course, we've got the PAYK, P-A-Y-K, run PAYK, PE. Yeah. Yeah, PAYK run. I'm not sure. I don't know. I might not be pronouncing that correctly. I don't want to say pike run, but who knows? But yeah, whatever it is, run PE often refers to kind of a description of a portable executable or a binary that's been observed, a piece of malware, if you will.
Yeah, I feel like we could have a specialized entomology class at university just to talk about like the history of naming in this space.
Oh, we've gone down that road many times where we've tried to identify which APT is this, which spider is that, which worm is that. Yeah, who knows?
All right. So, well, a fake browser update is exactly what it sounds like. When a victim visits a compromised website, the malware generates a fake update tailored to the browser the victim uses, such as Google Chrome, Microsoft Edge, etc. Basically, they see a message that says their browser is out of date, and in order to view the content or download the thing that you really need, you need to update your browser. I can totally see how this method would be effective. You know, say you're targeting lawyers, you create a website that claims to have all the super useful contract templates, and maybe you even do have them. And then a junior lawyer somewhere who is up against a deadline is looking online for a particular thing that will help them do their job. And they come across your website, and right before they get what they need, they see a screen that looks official and says they need to update the browser before getting that thing. A lot of people are going to click that. And I saw some of the samples from this threat actor, and it looks like they did a lot of impersonating legitimate sites using type squatting URLs, things like Steam and other video game related sites. Yeah, I could just see how people fall for this. And if I think back long enough, I feel like I may have fallen for a similar technique around updating Adobe Flash back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is a very common technique. For anyone who's heard Chris and I talk about this, or it sounds a little familiar, you might remember way back when the fake updates campaign. This is kind of where a lot of this stuff stems from. It's this idea of fake updates being a notification that you can send to a user, which kind of subverts that trust and gets them to click a certain thing. And as Chris described, your browser needs to be updated is one where, you know, a lot of users out there, even some who might think they're a little, you know, have a little bit of technical acumen, might say, oh, I've got to update my browser. You know, for anyone who uses Google Chrome, it just randomly shows up that you need to relaunch up in the top corner. You need to relaunch to update. But browser updates in the past used to be pop-up windows. Hey, you need to do a thing, right? And of course, they're looking to target those types of users from there. But it is definitely one where, you know, it can catch any user off guard, I think. And the other special part about these particular attacks or this particular type of campaign is the way that they get delivered. It's not like a particular executable or a spearfish shows up. A lot of times these are done via like malvertising. So an advertisement that is malicious in nature and is on a legitimate web page and then just happens to render. And this again is another way of subverting trust in a weird way. If I'm browsing a legitimate, and Chris, you use the example of lawyers. I love that one because it gives a lot of outlets. If I'm browsing a legitimate legal website, not a .gov or a court system, but if I'm browsing a resource website that has ads on it and one of those ads gets caught in a malvertising trap, again, I'm browsing a trusted site, one that I've used before, and then I get a pop-up that says you need to update your browser, right? A lot of times, a lot of users won't correlate those two. They'll just say, oh, well, I'm on a trusted site and my browser needs to be updated. That makes sense. Let me click this thing. Where a lot of times it's actually because you were on that particular site, because it fell victim to a malvertising campaign, is why you're getting that particular pop-up. So it does subvert a little trust and should keep users on their toes as well.
Yeah, so FakeBat itself is a malicious dropper. It's very unique in that it uses MSIX installers packaged with heavily obfuscated PowerShell code. When the installer is run, the PowerShell script will execute and connect to the attacker's command and control server. In my research, I found that the threat actors were purchasing black market signed certs to get past the built-in security controls. Apparently, there's whole marketplaces for those, which I wasn't aware of. So the Malwarebytes article that I was reading offers a bunch of IOCs, some file hashes, and a long list of domains that I'm sure will change. Any takeaways from this one, Matt? This feels like one that's most easily solved with user education.
Yeah, user education, user awareness is going to be a big one here. This is, once again, going down that road of just telling your users what types of attacks are out there and things for them to look out for, right? Because you and it's a catch-22. I don't want to tell everybody, ignore updating your software, but I do want to be careful in the way we go about this. Another way to go about this might be to say, hey, there are specific channels through which we update software, and here's what they are. You know, if you're dealing with package management, MDM software, or anything else that might control package deployment, make sure your users know about that so that they know anything out of band just isn't regular for them, right? Number one. Number two, this one sounds a little bit weird, but if someone's in a situation where they're receiving a pop-up for a piece of software that they shouldn't have, I do remember that this article particularly referred to things like OBS Studio, OBS software and whatnot, which is a very, very popular video recording and streaming / broadcasting tool. Things like that is, hey, if you don't use that site or that piece of software legitimately, just don't navigate to it, especially on a work computer. That doesn't mean go get all the malware at home, but it does mean be careful about what you're downloading in your workplace and whatnot.
So next up, we have one from our friends at the U.S. Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, aka CISA. They said that they're investigating a breach at the business intelligence company Sisense. I hope I'm saying that right. whose products are designed to allow companies to collect telemetry from and view the status of multiple third-party online services in a single dashboard. CISA urged all Sisense customers to reset any credentials and secrets that may have been shared with the company, which is the same advice Sisense gave to its customers. Have you heard of this product format? This was a new one for me.
Yeah, Sisense is one I've heard of kind of in past. I've never used it personally, but it is a business intelligence platform. Allows you to gather, visualize data from various sources and things like that. For anyone who's never heard of it before, I've heard it compared to kind of like a Tableau before. I'm not sure if that's the right comparison to make, and someone at Sisense may be like, no way. They probably have bigger problems to solve today. But nonetheless, that's how I've had it described. Chris, I think, and you might talk about this a little bit, but where this becomes really, a real pain point for folks is the types of information that they might put in there, the things that they want to visualize, the access that gets given and whatnot. But I'll let you continue because I think you might hit this point a little further.
Yeah. So just like taking some copy from their website just to help people try and understand what this product does, it says, your products are analytics. Sisense accelerates product innovation through AI ML capabilities. Our global analytics platform lets customers drive better, faster decisions for their businesses and end users. And another snippet states that the user can convert data into revenue by building AI-powered analytics with pro-code, low-code, and no-code capabilities. In essence, it sounds like a glorified dashboard with some built-in analysis capabilities that has access to all your infrastructure. What could go wrong, right, Matt?
Yeah, no, we're just sharing lots of third-party access codes, API keys, who knows what else to bring all this data in. I think this is where folks need to understand why this breach is being given such a large, concern, such a large magnifying glass. I mean, look, CISA doesn't call out every breach. It does call out big, important ones. And this is one where, again, Chris, as we've talked about, I think the way that this software is used, the things that are plugged into it, and then as I'm sure as we'll hear in just a moment here, what was taken or how it was accessed can also be very, very damaging for a lot of folks out there as well. It's a little weird. You might not have your environment might not be compromised, but if you've shared a wealth of your data and or your third party data with a visualization or intelligence or business intelligence tool, it might as well have a lot of your secrets as well. I'll go a step further. If you are utilizing that platform to generate secrets or insight or drive revenue or whatever it might be, then your access and data going into that platform is itself the most important asset you have, right? What comes out of that is what you use to then drive the business forward, but it's what goes into it that generates it. This can be damaging for a lot of folks. It's not just like, oh, let me just make a dashboard out of a database table here. It can be very, very key data for some business operations.
Yeah, and you kind of nailed it, which I'll cover in more detail in a bit, but that's sort of why CISA gave this so much attention. I think the company only has a couple thousand customers, but each one of those customers has a lot of their infrastructure plugged into this thing. So a statement from Sisense is as follows. We engaged industry-leading experts to assist us with the investigation. This matter has not resulted in an interruption to our business operations. Out of an abundance of caution, and while we continue to investigate, we urge you to promptly rotate any credentials that you use within your Sisense application. And I'm getting pretty good at picking up that little bit of legalese speak in there, which makes me think that we've not heard the last of this one.
This is an active and ongoing investigation, and any comments from here on out will pertain to. Now, it's an active and ongoing investigation. Full disclosure, I'm not working this investigation. Chris, if you are, then good for you, but I don't think you are. Neither of us are working this investigation, I'm going to assume, which means we obviously can't comment. We don't know what's going on, and neither of us are armchair incident responders. However, it's an active investigation. It's still going on, right? It's still happening. And let's be clear. I think the more you read about this one right here, the more that the guidance from the company is to reset and reprocure, reconfigure everything. And I mean, if you're out the gate offering that type of advice, you're either really, really, ahead of the game, right? Burn all credentials down and everybody start over again. How bad is the breach? I don't know yet, but I'm going to tell everyone to do that just in case. Or we are early in the investigation and we're already seeing signs that that's what needs to happen. I would like it to be the former, right? I would kind of like the break glass moment to be just burn it down and start over again from a credential perspective and not waiting for the investigation to get you there. You know, Chris, we've seen this before publicly where sometimes it will be like, you know, all users reset your passwords. And then 2 weeks later, all users, please reconfigure your two-factor auth tokens, right? And then a little bit later, well, the data exposure was more than we actually thought, you know, versus right up front, it's like, if you're using legacy auth, do this. If you're using single sign-on, do that. If you're using multi-factor, do this. Change it, you know, and it's just a full list of really good guidance. So I'm hoping it's proactive, not reactive.
Yeah, we hope for the former, but it kind of sounds like it's the latter. Two trusted sources, but unconfirmed by SciSense, said the breach appears to have started when the attackers gained access to the company's GitLab code repository. And in that repository was a token or credential that gave the threat actors access to SciSense's Amazon S3 bucket in the cloud. Both sources said the attackers used the S3 access to copy and exfiltrate several terabytes worth of SciSense customer data, which apparently included millions of access tokens, email account passwords, and even SSL certificates. And yeah, like I mentioned, I think this is why CISA got involved. It appears the threat actors broke in and stole all the credentials for almost everything SciSense customers were connected to. What do we call this, Matt? It's almost like a supply chain attack, but has a slightly different flavor.
A touch, a little bit, right? I think it goes back to what we were saying in the beginning, where a business intelligence platform is going to be the one that houses all your telemetry that you use to then generate insights from. And that can feel a little bit like a third party. It's almost like post supply chain. I feel like if we were to think of supply chain as data coming into an organization, right? This is a little bit after that, where you're actually, all the data is already kind of correlated or collated into a particular place. And then that's the place that gets, you know, breached. It's almost like someone from a security perspective, almost like someone's SIEM gets hacked into. It's like, well, this is the aggregation point. So they've got access to everything that's in there. I think this is a really hotbed, a really crown jewel-ish, for lack of a better term, a really high value third-party application got compromised. And of course, that's going to result in compromise of its customers' data. And that's what we're seeing here, straight up. The other concerning part about this, of course, is just how quickly it can branch out. You know, let's just say, you know, let's do easy math, Chris. Let's say you and I are running a company like this, and we have 10 customers, and each one of those customers has 10 things plugged into our you know, our BI generator, our engine, or whatever it is. Even if there's a 50% product overlap, that's 50 connections that have spread out, right? Now multiply that by a few thousand, and you've got a pretty wide coverage where it's like, well, how far can this thing stem out? You know, because everything ends up just kind of being connected. And then worse comes to worse, you get access from the compromised company, you get access to a third party thing. Well, the token that was generated actually had, you know, for whatever reason, root privileges, for lack of a better term. And then now you've got third party root privileges in this other app. Well, then it branches and you can just keep going. That tree root continues to grow for a while if you're not careful.
Yeah. And I remember talking to, I think it was Luke Jennings from Push Security. He was talking about the SaaS cyber kill chain and, like, you know, the threat actors can get into those third party apps, create a token, you know, and sort of set themselves up with persistence. And so the original one gets burned down, but you don't have, you know, good audits for what should be where. And, you know, it's really easy for them to just kind of have a foothold in there that you don't even know about.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's one of the other issues, is it's not just stealing a username and password and then you just change the one password and you're done. It's really easy for them to just provision another, and just keep going until eventually someone's got to be exactly what SciSense has recommended, which is burn it all down, start over.
What about a hub and spoke attack? I don't know. I was trying to think of a good name for this.
I could see that as being a good classification of this one here, with SciSense kind of being that hub and the spokes being the customers that connect into it, right? And then it just continues to go out. I don't know. We need some sort of tree theme For some reason in my head, there's just tree roots that
trees,
just every time you dig, another root pops up and you just keep going and you're like, oh my gosh, how old is this tree? You know? And you just keep going because it's so embedded and so dug in out there, you know? And then I won't go too far down this road. But then the other option is, what if I connected my third party application to SciSense via the SSO of another company, right? That now that other company offering SSO isn't necessarily at risk, but it just turns into, well, is that access anything that can be abused? Can it be taken further? Or is there a golden way, a better way to set all of this up, right? And I think a lot of it is going to come down to least privileges, ACLs, and things like that. If I need to read telemetry from a third-party app and bring it into a business intelligence tool, that API key should only be able to do those particular things. So if in the event it does get compromised, I'm not worried about whatever happens. Yes, of course, I don't want anyone else to have access to my data, but I don't want to go audit all my API keys in a flash because we were a little careless with our ACLs.
Yeah. Fine green permissions for the win. Hopefully the SciSense customers get the memo and rotate all their access tokens, change credentials, etc. Hopefully the threat actors haven't moved too far down that spoken wheel or whatever tree we're calling it.
But yeah, I'm not sure how we'll have to think of, we'll have to coin some term here, like the oak root methodology or something like that. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
All right. This is the one that keeps on giving, and one of those times I wish we weren't as right as we were in our predictions. And of course, I'm referring to the Microsoft hack, which we first reported on back in January. CISA has confirmed that Russian government-backed hackers stole emails from several U.S. federal agencies as a result of an ongoing cyber attack at Microsoft. And yes, they stated it is still ongoing.
Yeah.
In a statement.
Oh. No, sorry. I don't like to look at past episodes and say we told you so, but we definitely had a little bit of an educated or experience-based guess about this one. And unfortunately, it looks like we might have been a little bit right, in which it's still ongoing. And oh, look at that. There's more details. I'll tell you what, CISA has been busy issuing directives lately because of all the different stuff they've had to cover up.
Yeah, and it's funny because the SciSense one, you know, when I talked about the legalese and their press release, it was this one that it reminded me of when Microsoft first released it, the ongoing investigation kind of language. So,
Oh, yeah. A little bit here, a little bit there. Oh, they had access to nothing. They only had access to email. They only had access to this email. Well, those emails, you know, and no offense. Look, I will issue this disclaimer for this episode, previous episodes, and future episodes as well. I know how intricate and massive these incident responses and these breaches can be. And when an adversary has had nothing but time inside of an environment, the things that they've accessed, it can be really hard to unravel that. So please don't think anything we say in jest is like a dig at anybody doing the investigation and stuff like that. It's more of an observation, which are that oftentimes what we see from a initial reporting perspective is often to, you know, it's the first impression. Right.
Yep.
Look, we're investigating. Here's what we know. We will update you as you go along. And if anything, that's what this kind of ongoing Microsoft breach is, a frequent update into an investigation that's ongoing. And we're seeing it live and we've got to counteract because every time we see a new report, it's like worse stuff happened, you know?
Yeah. And if you think about how global and massive and with all the historical tech debt and stuff that Microsoft infrastructure must have, I can imagine that it's like very difficult to find and inject threat actors from, you know, what's basically a global network.
I'm going to also take a shot in the dark, and I don't know for sure, but I'm going to take a shot in the dark and say that the folks who are responding to this incident, you know, they probably, Chris, they probably do some analysis for a week or two. You're right. And I have lived this pain. But they probably do analysis for a week or two, and then they follow some investigative thread that leads them to a system. And it's like, well, what domain is this system in? And they're like, oh, that's this domain over there, and it covers this. And it's like, that hasn't been in scope yet.
Yeah.
And then this one link brings it into scope, and then you run your IOCs or you run your I don't want to say scans, you run your hunts against that domain, and all of a sudden there's like 20 new systems. So it's like the you know, I view it as like a clock that tries to turn, and it's trying to complete that hour, and it's at minute 58, and it just goes back. you know, and then it moves up and then it's Mini 58 and then it goes back, because every time the scope gets expanded, the investigation just extends and it gets longer. So when you hear and read about these things as ongoing, a lot of times, I don't know for sure, but a lot of times what's happening is analysis gets to a certain percentage of completion and then there's a thread. Someone pulls on that thread and it opens up a new part of the scope. You've got to go back to the drawing board. And then, and that doesn't mean everything starts over, right? N plus one systems in an incident response perspective, N plus one systems should be easier because every new system you approach with a new set of IOCs, or I should say a larger set of IOCs. So system zero is where I find out the adversary used malware. PowerShell. Okay. System one. Okay. Perfect. I know they use PowerShell. I'm going to go look for these things, right? System two. I know they use PowerShell and Mimikatz. System three. I know they use PowerShell, Mimikatz, and they move laterally using SMB. So your ability to do at scale analysis grows as your knowledge grows. But if you increase the scope, that can delay the wrap up of the investigation, number one. But Chris, what really hurts, and I suspect this is probably happening as well, is when not only do you increase the scope, but then you also find new indicators, new evidence of compromise. You've got to push that back across the entire population. And you can go all the way back to system zero, and there might be a thing there where you're like, oh my gosh, this was also an adversarial footprint, but you don't know until system 40.
Yep.
You know, you don't know until you're back there. And sometimes that cyclical process can take a while, and that gets delivered to us as ongoing investigation.
Yeah. All right. So in a statement published Thursday, the U.S. cyber agency said the cyber attack allowed the hackers to steal federal government emails through a successful compromise of Microsoft corporate email accounts. So we knew all that. They went on to say, quote, Midnight Blizzard successful compromise of Microsoft corporate email accounts and the exfiltration of correspondence between agencies and Microsoft presents a grave and unacceptable risk to agencies. And of course, Midnight Blizzard, who are also known as APT-29, are agents of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, or SVR, and are behind many profile attacks, including the infamous SolarWinds hack, which I would say brought supply chain attacks into the limelight. They've operated since at least 2008, often targeting government networks in Europe and NATO member countries, research institutes, and think tanks. The federal agency said it is issued a new emergency directive on April 2nd, ordering civilian government agencies to take action to secure their email accounts based on information that the Russian hackers were ramping up their intrusions. CISA did not name the affected federal agencies that had emails stolen. And I think the last one we talked about, and this one really illustrates what is almost lateral movement between applications and organizations as threat actors leverage data from one breach to compromise another. What do we do, Matt?
We let the investigation continue, and we let the good folks at Microsoft and whoever else they've hired continue to work through this until we get kind of the full report. You know, very akin to SolarWinds, which you mentioned as well. These investigations take time, right? The worst thing we can do is speculate and kind of imagine what the worst scenario could be. We wait for the investigative findings to come back. I think one of the things that we called out, Chris, when we first talked about this one way but earlier this year, was that we probably don't know everything that's going on. There's likely a part of this behind the scenes that will never get disclosed, or areas of national security and stuff like that. I feel like we're butting right up against that sometimes, where, you know, we're kind of right up on that, like, okay, public, that's about as much as you get to know, because the rest of this has to pertain to government business or organizations or espionage or whatever it is. But nonetheless, we continue to just kind of watch the updates come out, and we learn and grow from what happened here, right? And not, it's not always the public that needs to learn and grow from this. In other cases, it might be Microsoft. Microsoft might be rolling back or advancing a bunch of new technologies or implementing a bunch of new things that they maybe didn't need before, maybe was on a longer time frame, or maybe they've had to find new ways to architect things. And those are the types of changes we'll see come from a breach like this.
And I know these threat actors will probably never leave Russia, but I sure do hope we get to report on some of them getting grabbed off a diverted flight somewhere when they try and take a vacation one day, because I love seeing these guys get pinned.
That's right. I'll tell you what, guys. If you want to take a vacation, I got a list of countries you can go to. Don't worry about extradition agreements. Just go there for a couple of days, and we'll take care of the rest.
All right. So the next one up is a perfect CVE of 10 tracked as CVE-2024-34000. Maybe perfect's not the right word, but I think this is the first 10 we've reported on. It's at least the first one I can remember. How often do you see a 10, Matt? And do you have any idea what the difference between a 9 and a 10 is?
I got to say, it's not every day you see a 10 in the CVE-CVSS score. Got to say, this one definitely threw me for a little bit of a loop, only because, Chris, to your point, when you're like CVSS score of 10, you're like, how bad is this thing?
Right?
Just how bad can this thing be? I think, and I don't know for sure, and I'll have to double check, only because I myself am curious about this. I've always wondered about the weightings that go into this, and I think a lot of times it has to do with kind of a risk calculation, ease of exploitation, impact, risk to the organization, so on and so forth, right? And you can see that because there are very impactful but very hard to execute exploits or vulnerabilities, I should say, that often get scores where if you read through it, and I see this a lot with like software libraries, you'll see software libraries that are like, you know, if you do this certain thing inside of this library, it can lead to this heap overflow. It can lead to this. It can do to that, which can result in remote code execution.
Yeah, very academic.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, okay, it definitely technically is a CVSS, but the things that you would need to weaponize this on a mass scale and cause significant business risk are not that high versus, as I'm sure you're about to discuss with us here, Chris, a remote code execution vulnerability in Palo Alto's PAN-OS. This one, a little bit of a wider footprint, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So from the article, it goes, on April 10th, 2024, Volexity identified a zero-day exploitation of a vulnerability found within the Global Protect feature of Palo Alto Networks PAN-OS at one of its network security monitoring or NSM customers. Volexity received alerts regarding the suspect network traffic emanating from the customer's firewall. A subsequent investigation determined the device had been compromised. The following day, April 11, 2024, Volexity observed further identical exploitation at another one of its NSM customers by the same threat actor. The threat actor, which Volexity tracks under the alias UTA-0218, was able to remotely exploit the firewall device, create a reverse shell, and download further tools onto the device. The attacker focused on exporting configuration data from the devices and then leveraging it as an entry point to move laterally within the victim organizations. So basically, a low-complexity attack that doesn't require user interactions gives the attacker root and is on the internet-facing devices that can be found with services like Shodan. In fact, I did a little digging, and there are over 82,000 PAN-OS devices exposed online and vulnerable to this attack, 40% of which are in the United States, and this is why I can never sleep at night, Matt.
Yeah, this is, look, there's a handful of, I just have some reflexive thoughts on this, Chris, which is there's a handful of very, very big vendors who have double digit percentage market share, you know, and when a vulnerability like this comes out, and we've discussed multiples of these categories of vulnerabilities on this show. We've talked about VPN vulnerabilities, internet facing kind of perimeters, firewalls, load balancers, all those things that are devices that are designed to be externally facing. They're designed with software to be externally facing, right? And there's a lot of developers in the world who would hate that premise. You know, they just no. Like I designed my stuff to be wrapped inside of a corporate network, or I rely heavily on multi-factor authentication or SSO with a third-party provider or something like that. You know, but to design a piece of software which is meant to be internet facing can be a daunting task when the pool of people who encompass enterprises is very small. Then these vulnerabilities reach very wide.
Yeah.
And when you deal with things like a vulnerability or a potential RCE on a VPN facing device or a network perimeter secure, or a network security perimeter device or some other kind of public facing qualification, it goes zero to hero really fast because you've got a big market share. You've got a lot of potential exploitation. And unfortunately, Chris, as you called out here, it's not that hard to exploit. We're talking, you know, permissions aren't needed. A weaponized script can just be sent out there. And as you said, there's a lot of open instances out there. And unfortunately,
That's going to result in a very high CVSS score, but also a wide, wide target field for exploitation.
Yeah, and I saw some speculation, too, that this it must be a nation-state actor just because of the resources required to develop an exploit for a piece of hardware like this, right?
Yeah, I read that as well. I think that's an often common assumption, and I'm not saying it's wrong. It is an often common assumption because it takes a lot of work. It's not like I'm going to sit down and write some malware that encrypts a bunch of files and then, oh, look at that. AV detected it. Let me change this. Oh, AV detected it. Let me change that, right? This is spending time in a proprietary operating system to the point that you understand how to exploit it. First off, that operating system is technically limited to a very, you know, distinct developer pool. And then in a kind of packaged version, customers. So yeah, it's a lot of resources and a lot of development work to get in and actually start to rip that thing apart. And I think that often leads to this has to be, or it feels a lot like it's a nation state, just because they're the only ones who have the time and resources to do that. And let's be clear, I can't just walk to the Palo Alto store and purchase one of these devices and then rip open the software, right? It's contract negotiations. It's procurement. It's a sales process. It's all sorts of stuff to get in there. You're vetted very heavily. It's not just like, let me just go get this thing and I'm going to spend $500,000 and then launch some ransomware or something like that, right? It's oftentimes we know where this sits. Chris, the other side of this, which I'll just mention really quickly, is the customers who will utilize this type of thing also often constitute the target pool for this. And a lot of times that does align with nation state targeting objectives and things like that.
Yeah. Larger corporations, government organizations, stuff like that. Yeah. All right. So the company has now fixed the security flaw and hotfix releases issued for panel S10.2.9-H1, 11.0.4-H1, and 11.1.2-H3. More hotfixes will be rolled out for later PanOS versions in the coming days. Admins still waiting for a hotfix can disable the device telemetry feature on vulnerable devices until a patch is deployed. Those with an active threat prevention subscription can also block ongoing attacks by activating threat ID 95187, the threat prevention-based mitigation option. Security is a feature. Who knew? I guess the old saying holds, patch, 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 right, Matt?
Patch, patch, patch as best as you can. Those of you running these devices, you should already know about the advisory. You should already know what's going on. Patch, patch, patch the best as you can. Folks, it's not every day we get to see a CVSS score of 10, right? I know we want to sit and bask in the sunlight, the radiant light of this CVSS score, but in all actuality, patch and cover up. As Chris mentioned, there's multiple updates out there. And if you are a Palo Alto customer, utilize those mitigation packs in order to turn this on, because I'm just going to say, this isn't one you want to get caught with 3-4 months from now. Just patch it, get it taken care of.
All right, Matt, that brings us to the end of episode number, I think, 118. Hard to believe we've done this many of these things.
I love it, Chris. Well, it's a huge, and again, a huge thanks and testament to you for continuing to keep the show going. So thank you for having me, as always, and a huge thanks to our listeners. It's great to have everyone here. And as always, before Chris says it, I'm going to tell y'all, jump in the Lima Charlie Slack. We'd love to have you in the Intel channel. You can see this stuff live and get the conversation there.
All right. Thank you, sir. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye.
See ya.
And that concludes this episode of the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas for future topics, please send an email to defenders@limacharlie.io. You can access the intel we talk about on the show in real time and join the conversation on the Lima Charlie Community Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with someone or leaving a rating or review. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening from. Thanks for listening in. We'll see you on the next episode.